And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, New York has a new mayor, a first, a Muslim, Zohran Mamdani. Mamdani beat out a former New York governor, Andrew Cuomo, a barely known Republican candidate, Curtis Sliwa. U.S. President Donald Trump is irate as he persevered to sway the election away from progressive socialist Mamdani toward a Democrat turned independent Cuomo and not his Republican colleague Sliwa. Now, strange, but hey, what isn't in U.S. politics these days? Now, what does Mamdani's election tell us about the present political climate in America? The fact he's been a vocal opponent of Israel's genocidal onslaught of the Palestinian people in Gaza. He's pushed a strong socialist agenda of reform of public services and welfare programs for struggling New Yorkers and has basically risen on a platform, a polar opposite of what got Donald Trump into the White House. These questions and more we'll be asking in today's Spotlight program. But first, here's a short report.
So Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
Cheers erupted across New York City as Democrat Zohran Mamdani made history, elected as the city's 111th mayor, and becoming both the first Muslim and the youngest person to hold the mayor's office in over a century. The 34-year-old lawmaker's meteoric rise from state politics to leading the nation's largest city culminated in a stunning victory over Republican candidate Curtis Sliwa and former governor Andrew Cuomo, who was endured by Trump.
After all, if anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one.
High-profile Democrats celebrated Mamdani's win, with Senator Bernie Sanders posting, "Zohran Mamdani pulled off one of the greatest political upsets in modern American history." But what was behind Mamdani's meteoric rise from polling at just 1% to becoming mayor of America's largest city?
The U.S. public are now, of course, leaning in favor of and are turning towards. So they see him as a beacon of hope, as a change, as something outside of the norm of what we see typically from the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And for the U.S. government, this is a huge threat, because it shows that the American public has the appetite for a grassroots-style politician who runs against the establishment.
Mamdani's election was not the only win by Democrats. They swept key races in the 2025 off-year elections, with the results seen by many as a referendum on Trump's second term. In Virginia and New Jersey, moderate Democrats won their elections for governor. Trump tried to dismiss the bad news in a flurry of social media posts. He justified the defeats by saying that he himself was not on the ballot. He also attributed the blow to the continued U.S. government shutdown. However, what is obvious is that Americans opposed Trump's endorsed candidates and expressed dismay over the country's direction under Trump's administration.
And now joining us our guests. We have Dimitri Laskaris, a journalist, lawyer, and political activist, joining us from Montreal. And also Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief from MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Hello to the both of you, and welcome to you both to the program. Leila, obviously, we're going to go ladies first, trying to do the noble thing here and start with You, pleasure to have you, Layla. Your thoughts, initial thoughts, I should say, on how polarized the U.S. is these days, Layla, evident in a number of political developments. Now, Trump, just a few years ago, he beats out Hillary Clinton in a huge surprise for many polls as well as voters. And his victory over Kamala Harris, not as surprising yet. His rise and that of Mom Donnie's, albeit polar opposites, a sign of the times in America. Your initial take on this.
First of all, good evening to you and to your esteemed guest, Mr. Dimitri Laskaris. I want to say that it's actually an amazing and refreshing thing to see this happen in today's world and in New York, in particular New York City, not because of the kind of politics that's happening at the, at one point, but it's also because this person managed to defeat not only the American propaganda and basically what you call those who are anti-Islam, who hold, like, they are Islamophobes and they hold the anti-Islamic thoughts, but also he worked against what you call the Israeli propaganda and every propaganda out there by the Zionists to actually quell him down. Remember that this city has the largest constituency when it comes to Jews in the U.S., and nearly two-thirds of them voted against him, and yet he actually managed to break through and make it as the first Muslim mayor of New York City and the youngest in nearly a century. So looking at the whole thing and how things played, Donald Trump standing against him with all his constituency and basically looking at who voted for him, you'd see basically the immigrants, the new ones, the new generation, the ones who believe in change, the ones who are fed up with the polarization of the Democrats and the Republicans, the ones who are fed up with the Israelis taking over U.S. politics, and the ones who are basically didn't have a voice in the past. Mamdani managed to actually speak to all of them within their languages when his when the other candidates, his opponents, actually were dinosauric in the way that they were prehistoric in the way that they what you call covered things. And at the same time, they didn't present solutions. He spoke about people's pain. He actually rose up from that pain. When it comes to rents, when it comes to basically harassment against women, when it comes to cleanliness of the roads, when it comes to putting New York first and America first, he addressed all of these issues. The rest only presented rhetoric to their constituencies, and their constituencies didn't actually believe much in them. That's why we saw the rise of Mamdani. He's presenting something new on the scene that they haven't seen, the people haven't seen in a long time because of the hegemony of the Israeli propaganda, the Zionist propaganda, and the polarization of the Democrats versus Republicans, agenda over the people of New York.
Interesting take, and thank you, Layla, for your initial thoughts, sir. Mr. Dimitri Laskaris, welcome to the program, sir. Thank you for your patience. Tell us, from your perspective, what have we learned from the rise and election of Mr. Mamdani as New York mayor?
Well, thank you for having me. I also send my best regards to Ms. Hatoum. Pleasure to be on a program with her again. And a hearty hello to your audience. I lived in New York City in the 1990s. I lived in Manhattan for 6 years when I started my legal career. Although I returned to Canada after the 90s, I did have occasion to go to New York many times, mostly for professional reasons. And I can tell you that even in the 90s, it was a political environment that was dominated by powerful constituencies in the Zionist community in the United States. And it became much more hostile an environment for Muslims and persons of Arabic origin after 9/11. Even friends of mine who had been pro-Palestinian, modestly pro-Palestinian in New York City, became quite hostile towards, Islam and Muslims generally in the aftermath of 9/11, which for them was a traumatic experience. So over the course of the next 10 years after 9/11, New York City became an increasingly hostile environment, frankly, for Muslims and for Arabs. And so to see somebody, Mr. Mamdani is not Arabic, but he certainly is not shy at all about declaring himself to be a Muslim. He's not remotely apologetic about that. He looks like somebody who comes from the global south. He, as we all know, stated that he would order New York police to arrest the war criminal Netanyahu if he stepped foot on the soil in New York. And to see this man with this kind of a candidate prevail in an election in which so much power and coercion and propaganda was brought to bear against him in New York City which in many ways is Zionist central in the United States, and to win in a landslide with, I think, slightly in excess of 50% of the vote and a third of Jewish New Yorkers voting for him, there is no question that this is a political earthquake. And whatever may happen from here on in, whether or not he's able to implement his agenda, this is a very bad sign for the Trump regime. And I think, as you quite properly noted, it's not just New York City. A powerful message was sent to Trump that the politics as usual are not going down well with the Americans, Trump politics, I should say. Mm. And he has to be asking himself very seriously at this stage, Donald Trump, what is going to happen in the midterm elections? And if he loses control of the House and the Senate, is he going to potentially face another impeachment proceeding? So I think he's got to be very concerned, and I think that's going to impact how he deals with Israel.
And these are really good points, Lele. We have to hand it to Mr. Lascaris. Mamdani, a Muslim, he rises in a city with the biggest Jewish population, not just in America, but outside of occupied Palestine, nearly 2 million or 1.9 to somewhere between 1.9 and 2.1 million Jews. That's only preceded by L.A., which is, has less than 700,000 Jews, just to put it into perspective. He strongly criticizes Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza and U.S. complicity in that genocide. Just a few years ago, you very well know, Leila, you couldn't get to Mr. Lascaris' point anywhere, not even to a city council, let alone think of becoming a mayor as a Muslim, condemning anything related to the Israelis.
Well, actually, this is true, and like, I rarely disagree with Mr. Lascaris, and over here, I agree with him 100%. But you have to understand one thing, that Mamdani doesn't stand against the Jews. He's against the genocide that's being committed by the Israelis. He's against Zionism. He's against occupation, and he had repeated it time after time. But he's not against having basically a two-state solution. He's not against what you call the Jews as Jewish people across the world. So at the end of the day, he actually presented himself as somebody who does not pose a threat to the Jews. His mm-hmm. agenda is not against Jews per se, just because he's a Muslim. He is pro everybody who is a New Yorker, and he's there to actually, what you call, enforce fixing up the situation of New York for the people of New York at this very time that is away from anybody's hegemony, and their taxes should go only to the people of New York and enhance the city. So I do believe that the Jews who voted for him understood the message very well. The ones who live in New York City understood the message very well. And the rising population, we're talking about the new generation, also understand that message very well. As Mr. Lascaris said, Trump should be very afraid, because Trump actually survived and won his elections, presidential elections, based on the propaganda and the show business that he used to run every now and then. He's really good with words. He's good with show business. But show business doesn't take you far away. It only takes you for a certain time. He might be facing impeachment going forward. The people don't believe him anymore. Like, he just tried it, like, a few moments ago, he gave a speech. He delivered a speech where he bragged about stopping 8 wars, which his country actually launched or had start up. I mean, like, bragging about stopping wars that they started, it doesn't make any sense. And then he spoke about the rare earth materials, among other things. So he's basically sending void words to his people, and the people are waking up to that.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Lascaris, when we see the U.S. president rally against Mamdani, many in the Jewish community in New York, obviously the Jewish lobby there, the APEC and whatnot, many rabbis and other Jewish leaders come out and spoken against him. He weathers this entire storm. From your perspective, Is it due to Mamdani, his platform, what he stands for and what he stands behind, or the fact that he's basically going against the status quo?
Well, if you're referring to, you know, the opposition to Mamdani and in some quarters, a majority of the Jewish community in New York City, I think a lot of it has to do with his criticisms of Israel. Mm. They are appalled that somebody has assumed the mayoralty of New York City who is not shy about saying that Israel is committing a genocide. And I think there is a lot of, you know, Islamophobia, frankly, in Zionist circles, not just amongst Jewish Zionists, Christian Zionists, secular Zionists, tremendous amount of Islamophobia. So that also, I think, is was a factor in their opposition to a man who is unapologetic about being a Muslim. You know, as I say, none of that succeeded in coming anywhere close to defeating this candidate. And it's really instructive to look at the Israeli press today. I suggest to people who are interested in seeing how the media in Israel are reacting to this, they should check out the Times of Israel, look at the Haaretz. I did that this morning. I haven't had a chance to check the Jerusalem Post. And they themselves are declaring that this is a huge problem for Israel, not simply because New York has gone the way of Zoran Mamdani, but because there was a virtual sweep by Democratic candidates across the country, and the polls show that the Democrats are overwhelmingly now hostile to the genocidal Israeli entity. You know, the support amongst Democrats has been absolutely eviscerated for Israel. So it's their worst nightmare come true that a party that has become dominated at the grassroots level by support for the victims of this genocide is in a position to return to power at all levels of the U.S. government, municipally, state government, and at the level of Congress and the Senate.
And do you share that optimism, Leila, that Mamdani is also basically his rise, and that there are more like him in the Democratic Party? Because a lot of people see him and a few other you know, far left-leaning Democrats as exceptions to the Democratic norm. The Democrats, for the most part, are, you know, all Zionist-leaning politicians, just like the Republican Party, that they're not much different when it comes to Israel's support for Israel. Do you see that changing, as Mr. Lascara said, right now, in real time?
Well, the thing is, if you look at the mayors who were elected over the past few days, you had the mayor of Dearborn Hills, for example, Mohammed Baydoun. He's also a Muslim, and he basically won with a landslide. If you look at the constituency, both among the what you call the Republicans and the Democrats, both of them, the younger generation is actually rising against the hegemony that the Zionists have practiced over their own country and their basically parties throughout the past period, throughout the past years and decades as well. I mean, if you look at the whole situation, they are rising basically for what you call America first, not Israel first. And we see it also in their media and social media. So at the end of the day, it's not only the Democrats, but it's also the Republicans. We're talking about the new generation. And there are some who are middle level, what you call officials, who are fed up being told what to do. At any point, they are also breaking the norms and speaking against being dominated by a foreign agenda or working towards or for a foreign state that's not the U.S. So at the end of the day, all of that factored in towards people wanting change away from the former dinosaurs, as I call them, Cuomo, among others, those who actually sold people words, but they always presented an agenda that put another country, another foreign entity, another party that is not American before America and before New York and before anybody else in the USA.
And Mr. Lascaris, thank you, Leila. It seems that, you know, the word socialism or socialist agenda has been such a taboo thing in America for such a while now. But it seems many working class New Yorkers have welcomed Mamdani's socialist platform to improve certain public services, welfare programs, to tax the rich in New York, and corporate taxes up to 11.5%. This is, you know, next to his criticism of Israel, which is pretty much unprecedented until as of late. This is also another unprecedented aspect, another unprecedented dimension of his persona, isn't it?
It is. It's, you know, for socialists like me, this is a very promising development. And to be clear, I don't actually regard Mr. Mamdani as a socialist. I think he could more fairly be described as a social democrat, but by the standards of U.S. politics, which have become so, you know, neoliberal and neoconservative in recent years, he does look very much like a socialist. And, you know, a lot of people would even consider him to be on the far left. I don't. I think he's a moderate. But nonetheless, the policies you've mentioned, he's talking about public groceries, free buses, you know, a rent freeze, which, you know, is hotly opposed by the moneyed elite in New York City. He's talking about building 200,000 housing units to alleviate the housing crisis. Childcare. He clearly is focused on improving the lives of ordinary citizens and redistributing wealth and privilege from the billionaire class in New York City, which is extremely powerful, to the ordinary citizens of New York City. And if he can implement even half of his agenda, that is going to be a really, I think, powerful message to the electorate in the United States about what can be achieved through electoral politics. And you're going to see a lot more of this phenomenon all over the country. So I hope that he will at least be able to succeed in implementing a decent part of his agenda. That remains to be seen.
And he hit the nail right where I wanted to, Layla, that you're going to see. And why are you going to see more of this across the country? Because this is a testament to how struggling and how you know desperate so many Americans are to make ends meet, to welcome socialist-type policies.
Well, if you look at the whole situation of the U.S. since 2016 until today, since Donald Trump's first tenure until now, if you see the amount of debt, national debt that the U.S. has amounted since then, we are now entering $38 trillion of national debt. The Americans have to work 2 to 3 jobs to make ends meet, barely making ends meet. Inflation is still high. Jobs are not that high. They tamper with the official numbers that they put out, JOLTS numbers, among others, non-farm ADP payments and stuff like that. All of that is played by the U.S. administration, and they present it as if it's good whenever the president has a speech, but later on they adjust it after a month or so down the line. So the Americans know that the situation is bad for them. Most of their taxes go to feed the corrupt milieu, and that corrupt milieu is in the basically what you call the back pocket of AIPAC and the Zionist League, as I call them. And they work for the Israelis, not for the U.S. When it comes to their taxpayers' money, it goes to feed into the Israeli best healthcare in the world, the Israeli basically defense system, the Israeli wars, the Israeli lifestyle. When the Israelis can actually afford to travel across the world with universal healthcare, while the average Joe in the U.S. cannot actually even have a proper healthcare, if they have a healthcare, then basically that tells you a lot. And people are waking up to that reality. They can't afford their homes. The Israelis can. So why should they pay for the Israelis? And when you ask their officials, and the officials actually bluntly online, like publicly, openly, and say that they are pro-Israel first, that makes the Americans question their own administration and their own political parties. And that's why we're seeing change across the U.S. Look at what happened to Charlie Kirk. He started speaking about reality. He started questioning the Israelis. He started questioning why our taxpayers' money going there. And suddenly he got killed. And then you have other big influencers across social media. Social media has played a very important role in waking up people. People are asking questions where mainstream media cannot quell them anymore. And even when you put the algorithm to quell these people on social media, they cannot.
Thank you, Layla. We have time for one more question. Dimitri, we're going to come back to you. Mamdani, in his victory speech, took quite a few shots at the U.S. president, saying he's going to counter the policies of division and cronyism that got Trump into the White House. And then, turn up the volume to Trump, to basically listen to Mamdani's basic attack on him. And Trump tweets, so it begins, possibly alluding to his threat to defund or start to defund the New York City, and in response to Mamdani's victory. Now, one has to ask, are these two men serious? There's so much for these two men to address for their base, for Mamdani, New Yorkers, desperate living conditions, and for Trump, the lives of Americans, from crime to homelessness to acute economic hardship. And here they are declaring war on one another. How concerning should that be?
Well, the United States is a country that is overwhelmed with firearms. There are more firearms in circulation in the United States than there are people. There is a assorted tradition of political assassinations in the United States. Donald Trump himself was the subject of that. We just saw the killing of Charlie Kirk. There were the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy, JFK, and on, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. So, you know, this is a dangerous moment, not because of anything that Mamdani has done or said. He simply reflects the popular will of the people of New York City. But in the current environment, this is a dangerous moment. And frankly, you know, I hope that Mr. Mamdani has a very professional and trusted security detail, to be perfectly blunt about it. In this environment, anything is possible. But this is an extraordinary opportunity for the Democratic Party, because the people are finding out in the United States right now that this populism of Donald Trump was a fraud from the very beginning. He's kicking people off of the, you know, the healthcare rolls. He's instituting huge tax cuts again for the billionaire class. Life is becoming increasingly unaffordable for Americans. At the very moment when they are finding out that the populism of Donald Trump is a fraud, they have an opportunity to show to the American people, through not just Mamdani's victory, but other Democrats as well, that the Democrats are prepared to actually improve the lives of ordinary American citizens. And let us hope that the Democrats don't foul this up, because frankly, they've done that over and over again. And I think the most egregious example of that in my lifetime is Barack Obama, who came to power with so much promise, swept up many people, including myself, you know, brought to tears by his victory in 2008. And he proved to be a traitor to the cause at every step of the way during his 8 years in the White House.
All right. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Pleasure to have both of you. Thank you dearly. Dimitri Lascaris there joining us out of Montreal, and Leila Hatoum joining us from Beirut. This brings us to end your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah ya Allah subhanallah. الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to RIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad. I'm the host of this show. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that is very influential, and we can learn many lessons from that.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
We're continuing the discussion about fitra in the words of Imam Khomeini. We said that fitra is something that Allah placed in all human beings, and it's a divine and good tendency to all that is good, anything that you can imagine. Imam Khomeini says, should there be anything contrary to the fitra, it would not be fitra, and must be excluded from it. Okay? And hence we have the ayah which says, the fitra in which Allah has created the people. It means that it is not confined to a particular group. Imam Khomeini continues saying, he also said, there is no alteration of Allah's creation. That is, nothing changes it, unlike other things, such as customs and other things which are alterable. Now then, how is it, he continues, it's strange that even though there's no dispute about fitra from the very beginning of the world until its end, it seems that the people, they're not aware that they're actually agreeing with each other. They're concurrent with one another. He says, They think they are not, unless they are reminded. And that is when they will realize that they were agreeing in the form of differing. Okay? That is why the ayah ends by saying, but most people do not know. So it's not contradictory that, let's say, two human beings, they have totally differing views. It's just that they feel that what they believe in is correct and is the truth. But one of them has to be right. You can't have two truths, right? So when they come to know the truth, they will find out that it's only possible for the truth to be one. Okay, and that's why the verse says, most people do not know.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
The rules of the fitrah, Imam Khomeini continues, the rules of the fitrah are more self-evident than any axiom, because there is no such an intellectual judgment in which no one differed or will differ. It is clear that such a thing is the clearest of necessities and the most obvious of axioms, and whatever is correlevant to it is also of the most indispensable necessities. So if monotheism or any other sort of knowledge of the rules of the fitrah or of its necessities, then they must be of the most obvious axioms and necessities, but most people do not know. So all human beings, they are on the journey of uncovering the truth. And once they realize the truth, they will know that monotheism is the truth. Worshipping only Allah is the truth. That there has to be only one religion, and that's the religion of Allah. But for some human beings, this is a very long journey. Some of them do not reach the destination, unfortunately, and some do.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Why?
چون من
یعنی
بازار
Urban transportation is certainly a story of the evolution of technology. It started from walking to riding animals, then to larger capacity steam-powered trains, electric trains, and motor buses powered by engines. It is a story of gradually increasing speed, vehicle capacity, and range of travel. It has shaped cities and structured the lives of those who live in them. Mobility is an essential characteristic of urban life because it defines the ability to participate in modern society.
Oh, hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program dedicated to exploring markets of various Iranian industries and how they connect us all nationally and internationally. This week, we will take a look at Iran's automotive industry yet again, which has been making major strides in terms of growth and output. So, let's get this show on the road.
Iran's auto industry can be broken down into three production segments: passenger cars, heavy-duty vehicles like trucks, and public transportation such as buses. We decided to specifically take a look at the markets for buses and commercial vehicles. In order to understand this market, we decided to visit a company that specializes in manufacturing various types of buses that are used for mass transit. Our journey took us to Asia Peshro Diesel Company in Esfahan province. This company manufactures a variety of buses and vans, among other things. It was first established in 1978 and began its work as an auto parts manufacturer. And after decades of experience, the company is now active in manufacturing buses of various types. The manufacturing facilities at this company stretch across an area of around 50,000 square meters. Here, it can produce well over 1,500 heavy vehicles each year. The facility is packed with the latest technology and automated manufacturing equipment to get the job done.
The global auto sector is highly competitive. In order for Iranian companies to maintain their share in the market, many have tapped into domestic academic potentials. Using such resources helps strengthen productions. Doing so also reduces the country's reliance on foreign suppliers, which has also decreased capital flight.
This company's main claim to fame is that it was the first to manufacture CNG-fueled bus engines. CNG is an acronym that stands for compressed natural gas, which is a more eco-friendly alternative to gasoline. By manufacturing this engine, the company was able to achieve the Euro 6 emission standardization. Essentially, this means that the vehicles matching this emission standard meet some of the standards necessary for European sales. Impressively, 60% of the heavy vehicles here are manufactured inside these facilities. That's a number one doesn't see very often. Among its products, one can name minibuses and mid-size buses in two models, and 12-meter buses in three model types. Also, it manufactures 18-meter buses as well as airport buses. This firm has partnerships and licenses with foreign brands, namely Mercedes-Benz heavy vehicles. It can design and manufacture the molds and assemble all the necessary parts for various intercity buses and distance traveling coaches. Aside from this, it also manufactures minibus parts with the annual capacity of 400,000 units.
People travel in order to meet their primary daily needs. We travel to go to work, to buy food, or get essential services. Many travel for personal development, they go to school, to cultural facilities, or for entertainment, such as sporting events. Mobility stems from needs because rarely do people travel for the sake of travel itself. And this idea creates a huge demand for means of transportation.
One might like to know that most of the sales at this company are based on customer orders. For example, if a city needs a certain number of buses, they would enter a contract with an automaker. The city is supplied with transportation and the automaker benefits from efficient use of its resources while making a profit. This company produces all its vehicles along the lines and standards for exports. So, international customers can also purchase these products and any surplus is exported to neighboring regions. This manufacturer directly employs over 400 people, including engineer specialists, technical workers, and other staff. It has plans to expand its production facilities to reach over 6,000 units per year. This expansion would provide an extra 2,000 employment opportunities as well. Much of the raw material needed to produce the exterior body parts and some interior items are domestically supplied. The country has rich iron and petrochemical resources from which steel and polymers are produced and supplied to domestic manufacturers. But there are some technologies such as engine components that still need to be imported in order to manufacture cars and heavy vehicles. This company believes that the US-imposed sanctions were an opportunity for Iranian industries.
Companies such as the one we just mentioned and other heavyweights in the auto industry are stepping up productions. But the question is, why are they doing so? Aside from increasing profits based on the fifth economic plan outlined by the government, auto production is also meant to increase, and not just in the passenger car sector.
In 2016, the government announced a scheme to replace old and run-down public transportation vehicles, such as buses and taxis. Currently, 1.9 million heavy and light vehicles are operating in the country. Of this amount, nearly 600,000 units are old and outdated vehicles. This translates to roughly 30% of the total just mentioned. Of this 30%, 65,000 units are extremely old. So the government has begun the process of phasing out vehicles that are run down and also cause a lot of pollution. Let's take a look at the capital city of Tehran, for example. The Tehran municipality has decided to spend over $19 million on new buses to bolster the aging public transportation fleet. One of Iran's major automakers was contracted to deliver minibuses and CNG hybrid buses worth over $19 million.
Iran's auto sector did experience a lull in production for a couple of years after 2017. This was mainly because of doubled-up sanctions imposed by the United States, which made international banking transactions difficult. During that period, many foreign brands left the country because they didn't want to risk financial backlash from the US. But the auto sector is still thriving, and it is full of potential.
Iran has a capacity to manufacture some 1.6 million cars each year. This number is expected to increase to 3 million units in the next 4 years. That's based on the fifth economic outlook plan outlined by the government. Last year, Iran produced over 1 million units of various cars. This means that car production in Iran went up by 19% relative to the previous 2 years.
All right, I'm going to make a quick stop and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Here, take the wheel and teach us all something new.
We are surrounded by cables. We have become so used to them that we hardly even notice them until they disturb the decor or make us trip. However, if we didn't have them, daily tasks like switching on a light in a room, using a lift, turning on a computer, or even keeping a mask in place on our noses wouldn't be possible. Cables and wires come in different shapes and sizes, and the technology needed to ensure a wire stays in good working order for an acceptable period of time without any problems involves complicated operations.
All of the materials, machines, and tools you see around me play a hand in the entire wire manufacturing process. And now that we know just how important wires are in our day-to-day lives, let's take a closer look at their production process, step by step.
The Kayvon Wire and Cable Company started out with only one product line and average basic equipment and machinery back in 1998. They have come a long way since then, catering to a diverse range of customers, gaining a better understanding of their production capabilities and market requirements that's helped them anticipate different conditions and adapt. Once the condition of the wires set to be produced have been determined and the wire designs have all been drawn up, the required data is sent to the foundry.
After the copper, aluminium and galvanized wires arrive from the foundry in the form of coils, they are placed onto devices and are moved onto wire reels or wire drums, as they are sometimes called. They do this so that wires can be placed in another device for the next stage, which is the wire drawing. In this stage, different devices stretch and pull the wires equally, equal pressure from start to finish, so that they can reduce the diameter of the wire to the diameter that they want. So you can get different wires with different diameters depending on what you need.
In the last stage of wire drawing, all the wires undergo a heat treatment called annealing. The aim of this stage is to increase ductility and conductivity. Not all wires are used as conductors of electricity, though. Wires and cables have an almost equally important role to play in the cosmetic, health, and packaging industries. The following stage of the manufacturing process can either be stranding, in which wires are grouped together and spun around a common axis to get a thicker wire or cable, or covering, depending on the product. For example, if they're going to be used for electrical wiring, the stranding stage is required. But if they are going to be used as nose wires in face masks, stranding is irrelevant. And now you know that even the tiny nose wires that we've all been bending into shape for over a year now aren't easily made. The road to success isn't always easy, especially when facing long and short-term market imbalances. Since in today's global marketplace, even small shortfalls or surpluses can lead to significant price variations.
Even though over the past few years, volatile copper, metal and different alloy prices have led to numerous problems in the wire industry, the Kayvon Wire and Cable Company has not only managed to stay afloat, but also surpassed many of its rivals.
Many thanks for that educational report, just like always. Well, we have reached the end of the road for this edition. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا